Yeah, and this idea of binding.
Oh, yeah.
Guiding. Binding the public mind.
Podcasting from an underground studio flying under the radar, this is Dan. By day, I'm a professor of cognitive neuroscience, and by night, I retreat into my subterranean lair and dig deep into the thoughts of mankind.
Dad, why do you say subterranean lair? Isn't this just our basement?
Yeah, but subterranean lair just sounds cooler.
And I'm Dave, sitting firmly atop the Great Canadian Shield in Northern Ontario. I'm a pastor by profession, and a part of that includes unmasking the messaging that comes at us each and every day.
You're listening to the Knuckleborn Podcast, the best podcast in the world!
Well, I appreciate the vote of confidence from Gracie there.
Yeah.
That's good.
That's six-year-old Gracie. I think she wants to be a podcaster.
Right. And we appreciate the confidence. Thank you, Gracie. And thanks for all our listeners. So welcome, everyone, to episode 4 of the Not Conform podcast, Propaganda and the Progressive Liberal Democratic View. In this episode, we want to explore the relation between propaganda and democracy.
Yeah, Dave, before we get into this episode, I understand we've got some stuff in the mailbag. Okay, and I'm thinking about email here. You want to dip into the bag and see what we got there?
Sure, definitely. So we got an email from Joshua, and he writes, good afternoon, fellas. I enjoyed your podcast, and I have been a fan of Noam Chomsky for some time, which is what brought me to your podcast. I searched Noam Chomsky podcast, and your episode came up, and I was drawn in.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And he continues, I appreciate your take on media bias propaganda and the liberal agenda. But I have been wondering for the last 3 episodes when you will point out the propaganda coming out of the White House. It feels to me a little bit that you are glossing over the current White House administration propaganda points, i.e. the crisis at the southern border. What a tremendous scare tactic. In Mr. Chomsky's book, quote, What Uncle Sam Really Wants, end quote, he laid out several tactics or news cycles that were used to keep populations under control by fear. I know and understand that this podcast is about the media, but I feel that there's an equal and unbiased slant to conservative media, and I look forward to and hope to hearing about your thoughts and or views on that as well. Well, thanks, Josh, for writing in. Dan, did you want to jump in at responding to that? I got a few thoughts, too.
Yeah, no, that's amazing that we're getting these kinds of messages, and it's clear that our listeners are informed. My thoughts, I think, initially are that we want to be very cautious about current events, like, for instance, what's going on at the border, because it's actually very difficult to know what is going on. And if you think about it, a lot of the information that you get about what's going on at the border is from the media. And as we pointed out, the media's view on these things are biased. And you can also go maybe to alternative media, but they've also got skin in the game. So it's actually really hard to know what's going on. And that is, in fact, a fundamental point that we want to make throughout our podcast is that when it comes in the moment to trying to figure out what's going on, because the media are biased and various information sources are biased, it's very difficult to know.
Yeah, so it's been very easy to grab a few things where the media has been bashing Trump, because most of those have been, once the wider context becomes exposed, it's very clear to see where the bias comes from. On the example that our listener points out with the scare tactic, and we don't want to minimize that this is a scare tactic, and we would actually really appreciate this reference to the book, and we'll take a look at that. But for example, with the crisis at the border, well, since our listeners has written in, even in the last week, we've got a number of headlines that point to, and not from conservative media, but from articles like in the Washington Times, record arrests of illegal immigrant families on border bolsters Trump's emergency claim. So, I mean, these are sources that are not really necessarily friendly to the president. Right. Mm-hmm. Another one here. This is from NPR. Migrant families arrive in busloads at border crossing hit 10-year high. So, and then I've got a few more. There's another one from Breitbart that talks about, and you can, if you don't like the leanings of Breitbart, you might be tempted to dismiss it, but you got to figure if the numbers are right, they're right. And it's a matter of following that up. So illegal immigration under Trump projected to surpass Obama era levels. And in another article, they're pointing that in March, I think it's supposed to hit something like 100,000 apprehensions, right? So it's hard to know exactly. We're not, especially Canadians, we're not anywhere near that border. It's hard to know what's true. And so we're kind of reticent to comment on it when it might prove out to be false. But certainly some of the video I've seen suggests that there might be a crisis at the border. And we might get into actually a Canadian crisis at our borders where there's open immigration and the costs that are pouring in.
Yeah.
But we'll keep an eye out for that. And I think another thing to note is that we have actually been pointing out a lot of White House propaganda and just been historic propaganda.
Like that's
the
right.
Babies in the incubators, the Iraq war stuff, all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, so, both on the left and on the right. Because there's a lot of propaganda to go around. And one thing is clear, Dave, that we want to say, I think, is that it's very clear that the Trump administration in the States is engaged in propaganda. Absolutely. That's, in fact, the key point that we're, I think, trying to make repeatedly is that all governments are engaged in propaganda. And in fact, that brings us back.
We're going to make that point today.
Yeah, that brings us back on topic here because we want to talk about how some people view propaganda and its role in democracy. So let's jump right into that, Dave. How would you describe the common view of democracy that people hold in the West?
Well, I think it would be something like this. You could summarize it this way, that people have a role in directing the course of public affairs through the voting process.
Yeah.
So that's one. Mm-hmm. A second point would be something like the politicians, they're in fact, and the whole government bureaucracy are there to carry out the will of the people.
That's right.
Okay. And three, the people have to be correctly informed about the true state of events in the world by the media and by the education system.
And according to this common view of democracy, government propaganda, which would be defined as deceptions created to manipulate people that would be pushed by the media and the education system, would fundamentally undermine democracy, okay? Because it would lead to a misinformed public. So it's all about democracy, the common view hinges on people being properly informed. Now, here's a clip from Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau trumpeting the importance of an independent media for democracy.
Honourable Prime Minister, Mr. Speaker, a free and independent press is the cornerstone of any democracy. We understand that.
So our listeners might recognize this clip because I think we played it in the context of Trudeau defending his government's plan to fund the media, which obviously will achieve exactly the opposite of what Trudeau is saying to the public, which raises the question, does he actually believe what he's saying, or is he operating from another worldview? Okay, now in contrast to that, here's a clip from the BBC interview of Noam Chomsky we included in an earlier episode. And recall that Noam Chomsky was a professor at MIT, and he's an expert in world politics.
The term propaganda fell into disfavor at around the Second World War, but in the 1920s and the 1930s, it was commonly used and, in fact, advocated not by leading intellectuals, by the founders of modern political science, by Wilsonian progressives, and, of course, by the public relations industry as a necessary technique to overcome the danger of democracy.
Did you hear that, Dave?
Yeah.
Propaganda as a necessary technique to overcome the dangers of democracy. That's kind of shocking.
Yeah, we should just pause here for a second because, I mean, how could that be?
Yeah.
It flies in the face of the common way of thinking about democracy.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's completely antithetical or opposite to or in contradiction with this common view of democracy that we just outlined.
That's right.
Which basically involves the informed public making informed decisions.
Yeah, well, I think it turns out that the progressive liberal democratic thinkers of which Chomsky's talking about have a completely different view of democracy itself. And here is Chomsky's description of this alternative view.
The basic picture is, look, the general population are, these are just quotes, are ignorant and meddlesome outsiders who have no, we have to keep them out of the public arena because they are too stupid. And if they get involved, they'll just make trouble. Their job is to be spectators, not participants. They're allowed to vote every once in a while, pick out one of us smart guys. But then they're supposed to go home and do something else, like, you know, watch the football game or whatever it may be. But the ignorant and meddlesome outsiders have to be observers, not participants. The participants are what are called the responsible men, and of course the writer is always one of them, you never ask the question why I'm a responsible man and somebody else is in jail, let's say, but the answer is pretty obvious. It's because you are obedient and subordinate to the power, and that other guy may be independent and so on. But that you don't ask, of course. So there's the smart guys, and we're supposed to run the show, and the rest of them are supposed to be out. And we should not succumb to, I'm quoting from an academic article, to democratic dogmatisms about people being the best judges of their own interests. They're not. They're terrible judges of their own interests. So we got to do it for them for their own benefit.
Chomsky refers to this view in his book, Media Control. He refers to it as the progressive theory of liberal democratic thought. Okay. And you notice that's a very different idea of democracy than the common one that we outlined at the beginning.
Yeah, so some of these thinkers that Chomsky is referring to, we're talking about people like Walter Lippmann, who we mentioned briefly in an earlier episode. And you might recall that Lippmann was a Pulitzer Prize winner and the author of the influential book titled Public Opinion, published in 1922. And he further developed some of the ideas on democracy and a public opinion in a later book titled The Phantom Public, which was published in 1925. Apparently, he was the one who made the term Cold War popular, so you can imagine this guy was very influential.
Mm-hmm.
And as we mentioned before, he was heavily involved in American propaganda during World War I, and he saw this propaganda in action, and he saw how effective it was.
Yeah.
And Chomsky would also be talking about Edward Bernays, whom he encountered before.
The father of public relations.
Yeah, that's right. The political scientist Harold Lasswell.
Yeah, I think we mentioned him in an earlier episode as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, so this is quite the crew. I mean, these are the liberal democratic thinkers of the 1920s and the 1930s and so on. So, Dave, when I first heard this, I confess I was thinking like, it sounds a little extreme. Maybe Chomsky's exaggerating a little bit. Did guys like Lippmann and Bernays really hold the views and the beliefs that Chomsky describes?
Yeah, I share that. I share that. I wonder if some of our listeners might be feeling the same way.
Yeah, so let's go through the main tenets of the progressive liberal view of democracy and read some passages from Lippmann and Bernays in which they express these tenets. Dave, maybe you could read some Bernays quotes and I'll read some Lippmann quotes. And I think we're going to show that Chomsky is not overstating the case. He's not exaggerating and that he's in fact quite accurate about his characterization. All right.
Yeah, this is important because it's very easy to doubt this as one guy until you see the same thought repeated in a bunch of these thinkers, that influence the elites.
That's right. And it's in their main writings as well. So we're quoting from some of their main books here. So let's start with what the first idea of the progressive theory of liberal democratic thought, as Chomsky called it, which is that people are incapable of governing themselves. Here's Chomsky on that again.
The basic picture is, look, the general population are, these are just quotes, are ignorant and meddlesome outsiders.
So people like Bernays and Lippmann argued that people in the general population can't govern themselves, partly because common people simply don't know enough to govern themselves. Or in other words, common people simply don't have enough expertise in enough domains of knowledge to make the best decisions for themselves or for society. And so here's a quote from Lippmann, and I'm quoting from the book The Phantom Public, quote, "Yet he's referring to the common people, cannot know all about everything all the time. And while he's watching one thing, 1,000 others undergo great change. Unless he can discover some rational ground for fixing his attention where it will do the most good and in a way that suits his inherently amateurish equipment, he will be as bewildered as a puppy trying to lick 3 bones at once." Bewildered as a puppy trying to lick. That's what we are, Dave. We're bewildered, yep, like puppies trying to lick 3 bones at once.
Yeah, I try to lick 4 at once.
Yeah. But that's right.
You can stick to 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, here's a quote from Bernays, and this is from Propaganda on page 38. So he says, "In theory, every citizen makes up his mind on public questions and matters of private conduct. In practice, if all men had to study for themselves the abstruse economic, political, and ethical data involved in every question, they would find it impossible to come to a conclusion."
And here's Lippmann again, And I'm reading again from the Phantom Public, page 29, quote, "The individual man does not have opinions on all public affairs. He does not know how to direct public affairs. He does not know what is happening, why it is happening, what ought to happen. I cannot imagine how he could know. And there is not the least reason for thinking, as mystical Democrats have thought, that the compounding of individual ignorances in masses of people can produce a continuous directing force in public affairs." So he's basically saying most people don't have a clue of what's really happening out there in the world, and so they can't possibly govern themselves or direct public affairs.
Yeah, and another reason that people can't govern themselves, according to this liberal progressive worldview, is that people have too many conflicting interests, and this precludes them from taking that correct collective action.
I have here a quote from Lippmann that supports that, quote, "There's no human point of view, but only the points of view of men. None is valid for all human beings, none for all human history, none for all corners of the globe." And so notice he's taking a very profound relativism here. He's saying basically that everybody has their own interest, very different views, and so people just won't be able to agree. And I guess a lot of these interests, one could argue, would be conflicting, right?
Sure, and the only one that really matters as an influence maker is his, right?
Exactly. I got a few more here from Lippmann. Quote, "The conflicting interests merely find a way of giving a little and taking a little and of existing together without too much bad blood. They still remain separate interests. The men involved still think differently. They have no union of mind or purpose." Again, everybody's just got their own separate worldview. And then here's another one, quote, "But even the successful practice of a moral code would not emancipate democracy. There are too many moral codes." So even at a moral level, he says, we can't agree. There are just too many disparate views out there. And that means you can't have an underlying common democratic view and a basis on from which to govern.
It's a bit of a quandary, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's no remedy for this, according to Lippmann. He writes the following. "These various remedies," and this is a part of the book, by the way, where he's already written about various ways of potentially fixing this. So he says, "These various remedies, eugenic, educational, ethical, populist, and socialist, all assume that either the voters are inherently competent to direct the course of affairs or that they are making progress towards such an ideal. I think it is a false ideal." So he says basically that the ways to fix it, including education, by the way, aren't going to work.
Fix the problem that he's outlined, as he's outlined it.
Exactly. And the key point here is that because things are just too complicated for the common person, and because people have conflicting interests, they cannot by themselves form the sorts of accurate, coherent, and unified public opinions that are needed for a functional democracy. Okay, so this brings us to the second tenet of the liberal progressive view of democracy, which is that there is an intelligent minority, a small elite, who are able to make the right decisions for the population. And here is Chomsky on that again.
"So the participants are what are called the responsible men. And of course, the writer is always one of them. You never ask the question why I'm a responsible man and somebody else is in jail, let's say. But the answer is pretty obvious. It's because you are obedient and subordinate to the power, and that other guy may be independent and so on. But that you don't ask, of course. So there's the smart guys, and we're supposed to run the show, and the rest of them are supposed to be out."
Yeah, so there's a small group of individuals, this intellectual elite, that are running the show.
That's right. And Bernays puts it this way. This is, I think, from page 57. "Only through the active energy of the intelligent few can the public at large become aware of and act upon new ideas."
Yeah. So again, an intelligent few. Dave, I have a clip from Aldous Huxley. Do you remember who Aldous Huxley is?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he's a sci-fi writer, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, he was the author of the book Brave New World.
Yeah.
And also The Doors of Perception, which talks about the use of hallucinogens to broaden one's mind. And I don't know if you know this, but he's also the brother of Julian Huxley, who was the first, I think, director of UNESCO, which is the educational arm of the United Nations. So these guys.
Yeah, that's right. And, and wasn't it Julian who basically wrote education theory that pretty much put into practice the ideas in Aldous's fictional works?
Yeah. This was a powerhouse family that had a huge influence on a number of things, including our current even education system. But listen to what he thinks, because people might still be thinking, listen, guys, okay, I'm with you so far, but this idea that there is this intellectual minority elite that are governing things, that's just crazy conspiracy land, okay? So I want to build this case a little bit more. Here is Aldous Huxley. Listen to what he says.
That if you are going to control any population for any length of time, you must have some measure of consent. It's exceedingly difficult to see how pure terrorism can function indefinitely. It can function for a fairly long time, but I think sooner or later you have to bring in an element of persuasion, an element of getting people to consent to what is happening to them. Well, it seems to me that the nature of the ultimate revolution with which we are now faced is precisely this, that we are in process of developing a whole series of techniques which will enable the controlling oligarchy, who have always existed and presumably always will exist.
Hey, did you hear that? The controlling oligarchy.
Who have always existed and presumably always will.
Yes. And so this is Aldous Huxley. Okay, he's British, but he's really connected in the academic sphere and in the governing sphere. And he clearly says here there is an oligarchy that's in control of things and always has been. And notice before that he's talking about, okay, how to control people. How do you then, as this minority elite, control people? Let me play the rest of the clip, Dave.
To get people actually to love their servitude. This is, seems to me, the ultimate in malevolent revolution, shall we say.
So he's saying, how do you convince the population then to actually love their servitude?
And this is a problem which has interested me for many years and about which I wrote 30 years ago a fable, The Brave New World, which is essentially the account of a society making use of all the devices at that time available, and some of the devices which I imagined to be possible, making use of them in order to, first of all, to standardize the population, to iron out inconvenient human differences, to create, so to say, mass-produced models of human beings arranged.
Mass-produced models of human being. They want to homogenize the population or standardize the population, Dave.
In some kind of a scientific caste system. And
sorry to interrupt, but scientific caste system. I mean, he's spelling it all out here, Dave.
Yeah, we're going to have to look into... Well, Huxley's not really one of my kind of in my reading sphere that much, but I'll have to take a look at that. But there's a whole bunch of other science fiction that comes out of this era.
Yes.
Where they're almost telegraphing these ideas and trying to normalize them in the public. We'll look at that in some other future episodes.
Yes.
Since then, I have continued to be extremely interested in this problem, and I have noticed with increasing dismay that a number of the predictions which were purely fantastic when I made them 30 years ago have come true or seem in process of coming true, that a number of techniques about which I talked seem to be here already, and that there seems to be a general movement in the direction of this kind of ultimate revolution, this method of control by which people can be made to enjoy a state of affairs which, by any decent standard, they ought not to enjoy. The enjoyment of servitude.
Man, I mean, it's just, it's shocking to actually hear him say that. And notice he points out that he raised a few methods of controlling the population in his book, Brave New World. And they're now, at the time, this was in the 1960s, he's speaking here, I think this was at Berkeley, they were starting to come true already. So that's that kind of prophetic nature of the science fiction writing that you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, Dave, Lippmann talks about the governing class as well, noting that democracy was not supposed to include such an elite class. And he says the following, quote, "But of course, the democratic theory was not supposed to produce a new governing class, and it had never accommodated itself to the fact. The idea of a special class of politicians was just what the Democrats did not like. But he could not have what he did like because his theory was derived from an ideal environment and he was living in a real one," end quote. So he's saying that the democratic theory that we most of us think is being implemented right now is actually a fiction based on an ideal environment that doesn't exist.
Yeah, big surprise, right?
Yeah, I think the idea was that ordinary people would each take turns in public office and then return back to their private lives. But this never materialized. And that was the idea, I think, of those that were pushing democracy, right? That you wouldn't have a specialized class that would emerge, a specialized governing class. And Lippmann says the following, quote, "Thus, rotation in office might be the ostensible theory. In practice, the offices oscillated between the henchmen," end quote. And think about people like Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, you know, who are like very long in the tooth. They're almost as old as Methuselah, and they're still ruling the people there, or trying to.
Yeah.
You know, you got the Bushes, right? The Clintons. And in Canada, you have the Trudeaus.
Trudeaus, right?
Yeah, like think about Trudeau, like Justin Trudeau right now. I mean, what kind of qualifications does he have to be a leader of a country, except for the fact that his father was a leader of the country some time ago?
Yeah, it was his father who talked about the philosopher kings, right? Mentioning back to Plato, this concept of a ruling elite and people being stratified into these classes.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about here. Yeah, the philosopher kings idea. I think people often assume that our political leaders are just regular people who, partly based on merit and otherwise mostly randomly, bubble to the top and are voted into positions of leadership. But this does not seem to be the case. There seems to be a ruling class that is developed in various countries in the West, and then the kind of the leadership of the countries just oscillates between these. So we're almost back into the days where kings would just marry amongst each other and, you know, rule different countries, rule different
kingdoms.
Yeah,
that's right. And at least that was out in the open, and you knew who you were being ruled by, right? Nowadays, there's just this it happens behind closed doors.
Yes.
Right? And then there's this revolving door between government, big business or think tanks and banks and the Federal Reserve and all that kind of stuff, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I can add here that some academics that I come in contact with hold a similar view, namely that the more intelligent members of the community, as Chomsky would say, themselves have to guide the stupid masses. And in academics, the scientific engineering of society was given into the hands of the social psychologists and the sociologists, maybe. And this turned out to be an epic disaster. Recall from our last episode that social psychologists are mostly left-leaning, which means that their views will not represent the views of the general public. And more importantly, with regard to the social psychologists, it's now coming out that there is a large replication crisis in the field, which means that some of the scientific findings that have been reported can't seem to be replicated right now, are just not found again. And this is specifically to certain kinds of experimental designs, the so-called between group or between participant designs. And we won't go into the details here. But the upshot of all this is that many older and seminal studies that have been taken as fact in social psychology are simply not replicable or reproducible. And this is referred to as the replication crisis. So the social psychologists, which have essentially been sort of put up, propped up as the new priests that were going to tell us how we all ought to interact in an equitable and fair and just way in society, are turning out to have misled the public in some way, and now they're trying to sort that out and get back on their feet.
Yeah, and so this assumption that these elites and this intellectual class actually know better than the public, that they can make better decisions, well, that's completely false, right?
Yeah, totally.
I mean, you have to think about it. They sometimes, like you talked about, they don't actually understand fully the complexity of some of the problem or some of the issue.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you're basing it on studies that can't be replicated, well, you're making decisions. It doesn't matter how good the decisions are if they're based on bad data.
Yeah. The assumption in this elitist view is that the elitists will do a better job because they're smarter and they can understand the complexities of the problem and the problems in society and in, you know, in the world, and therefore they can make better decisions. But it's actually... it's naive, right? Because the problems that we face in the world are too complex for anyone to fully understand. And so they're not going to do a much better job than other people might. And if we look at some examples throughout history, we can see how the elites have bought stuff. Like, for instance, in the 1950s, the medical elites, you know, were promoting, I'm just thinking of my own field here, were promoting lobotomies, which is the cutting or removal of brain tissue to solve psychological problems. This turned out to be an utter and complete disaster, you know? And we look back at that, yeah.
You think of the eugenics movement with Margaret Sanger and...
Absolutely. We'll get into that in another episode.
Ideas. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So they're kind of... They have a history of screwing things up, but they keep wanting us to trust them.
Now, we're not saying that it should govern people that govern shouldn't be selected based on merit. We're not saying we're not trying to argue against that. Obviously, you want the best qualified people and people who are capable governing you.
The point is that they're not being selected based on merit.
Yeah, that's the problem. And then there's the whole subversive aspect, the propaganda aspect of this that makes the whole thing very evil, I guess I would, maybe better ways to put it, but it is, right?
Yeah, and of course, right? Because they start to live in their own circles, right? They're just not exposed to people that are in other circles. These people in the elite class have no idea how the people in the working class actually live and what issues they care about, which is why you get these you know, places like, say, in Washington, right, where all these people live in their bubble.
Then there's the reality that everybody essentially is operating out of their own interests. And so this ruling class is going to have their own interests in mind. Mm-hmm. And you can't assume that they're altruistic, which is history just simply proves that not to be the case.
So, Dave, maybe it's worthwhile taking a look at some of the elites and their character. And since, you know, we're reading from Edward Bernays, he might be a good place to start. And I'm looking at Mark Crispin Miller's introduction to Bernays' book, Propaganda. And he talks a lot about the kind of achievements that Bernays had. And here's one. Listen to this quote. Quote, in 1953, Bernays helped put across the myth that Guatemala was at risk of communist subversion. Bernays was then employed by the United Fruit Company, at whose behest the Eisenhower administration used the CIA to overthrow the democratically elected government of Jacobo Arbenz. Thus was Guatemala forced to start its gruesome modern history as a quasi-fascist oligarchy. From that point on, the bananas and pineapples would continue to be safely picked by inexpensive native labor under careful watch, with all the profits flowing north. The possibility of some other, less explosive non-colonial arrangement was clearly not to be imagined by Bernays, just as United Fruit could not imagine it, and so it never could become a public issue here. And here he means in the United States of America. So here you have a case, okay, where Bernays uses propaganda and his services to overthrow a democratically elected government in another country. And I guess we could say that Bernays was actually involved in perpetuating the Banana Republic of Guatemala. And the term Banana Republic fits perfectly here because it does refer to countries like Guatemala and Honduras, which have been controlled or heavily influenced by foreign capitalist interests and have relied primarily on the export of a single crop like bananas. In fact, the United Fruit Company, for which Bernays worked, was involved in the Banana Republic movement in Central America. I read a book recently. I got so fascinated by that. I read a book by Schlesinger and Kinzer, published in 1982, called Bitter Fruit, The Untold Story of the American Coup in Guatemala. And here's a quote that reveals the nature of the problem that came about in Guatemala in the 1950s. So in 1950, quote, 2.2% of the land owner still owned 70% of the nation's arable land, end quote. So there was this massive land ownership inequity in Guatemala, and the land was owned primarily by the oligarchs, which would be the elites in Guatemala, and they were still left over from the colonial days. But the United Fruit Company owned a lot of land as well. And here's a quote from the book. Quote, the Arbenz government, this was a democratically elected one, had embarked on a land reform program that included expropriation of some of the vast acreage belonging to the United Fruit Company. The land reform was not popular either in the company's Boston boardrooms or in Washington, where the firm had enormous influence. United Fruit controlled directly or indirectly nearly 40,000 jobs in Guatemala. Its investments in the country were valued at $60 million. And remember, that was in the 1950s. Quote, it functioned like a state within a state, owning Guatemala's telephone and telegraph facilities, administering its only important Atlantic harbor, and monopolizing its banana export. The company's subsidiary, the International Railways of Central America, IRCA, owned 887 miles of railroad track in Guatemala, nearly every mile in the country, end quote. So there was this foreign capital control in Guatemala on a massive scale. Mm-hmm. For that reason, when there was this democratic initiative to expropriate some of the land of the United Fruit Company, the fruit company wanted to step in and essentially overthrow the democratically elected government. So they leaned on the services of Edward Bernays, who then created propaganda that convinced the CIA and the government, the United States of America government, to go in there and overthrow the Guatemalan government. And here is a quote about the press manipulation that occurred by the CIA. Quote, and there was an unprecedented trick in which Foster Dulles and his brother Allen, and by the way, Allen Dulles was the CIA head at the time, collaborated to blind the eyes of the American press and the American people as to what was going on. They deliberately deceived the publisher of the New York Times, Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, feeding him false and misleading information about one of the Times' best men, Sidney Gerson, to get him off the scene. Gerson was too good a reporter. He might spill the beans. End quote. So this is a fascinating story, right, Dave? Because notice there's this confluence of private interest, the United Fruit Company, the CIA, the government, and the military of the United States, and the whole thing is driven and orchestrated by a propaganda story that was, you know, influenced by Edward Bernays himself, where they basically made it seem as though the government of Guatemala needed to be overthrown because they claimed it was a socialist government and it could be communist. It was ostensibly a communist government. And so they had to overthrow them because communism was a threat to the United States of America. I mean, you couldn't write this stuff. My goodness.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really the same similar playbook that when we looked at the Chilcot Report that aired a bunch of similar types of motives going on in the Middle East.
Yeah.
Right? And think about how this could possibly apply to the Venezuela issue that's going on right now.
Yes, absolutely. I mean,
right? Like, we really don't know what's going on there. We really don't have any independent reports of you know, that you can reasonably trust that will give you news on the ground there?
Yeah, I think it's probably almost impossible to understand the real dynamics at play in Venezuela if we only consider the recent news. To understand what's really happening today, we have to understand the history of that country and, I think, also the region. Because what we've learned from the case of Guatemala is that there was massive foreign capitalist interference in the country, which, as we mentioned, triggered a more left-leaning movement by the population. And this was then falsely painted by the capitalists as being even more left-leaning than it was to justify a coup of the democratically elected government. And remember that at the time, this whole plot was hidden from the American public so that they would have no idea that it was actually going down. So as far as they knew at the time, the U.S. was helping to overthrow a communist dictatorship or a highly socialist dictatorship and instill democracy in Guatemala.
And it's Bernays in his book, he points out, and I don't have the quote readily on hand here, but that the World War I and II enterprise of selling this idea of democracy and using it as a propaganda tool was so successful that it's been carried throughout. It's one of the few tools that have stood the test of time and just keeps going and going and going, right?
Yeah.
Or storylines anyways.
Now, here's the interesting thing, Dave. Who were the elites pushing the propaganda that triggered the overthrow of this democratically elected government and then later controlled Guatemala? It was actually the capitalists, right? It was the American fruit import companies. They preferred an oligarchy in Guatemala. And by the way, for our young listeners, the term oligarchy means just a control by a small group, usually very wealthy people. This is an important point because it relates to other things we've mentioned before in earlier episodes. People have in their minds a dichotomy, namely that, you know, socialism on one side, capitalism on the other side, that these two occupy poles, opposite poles of a continuum, right? Left versus right. And so people think, oh, the one is bad and the other one is good. Now, so far we've been talking about propaganda control as being part of this liberal democratic view, right? And so you might associate that with a leftist socialist view of democracy. However, in the Banana Republic cases that we've just mentioned in Guatemala, we see the capitalists making use of propaganda to control public opinion, to have a country invaded, to dominate their food exports. So elite control of public opinion isn't just a left thing. It's both a left and a right thing. All of the isms, communism, socialism, fascism, capitalism, they all include a group of elites that exert control over the majority of the population, and this is done through propaganda.
Yeah, yeah. And if you think about just bringing it back to the border crisis we started out with that our listener wrote in about. So on the one hand, it's possible that you could have a problem with the American border where there's uncontrolled migrations, which in history have these things have always been bad in terms of changing societies. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. But then the other problem is why is there this uncontrolled migration? And these things that you just exposed in Guatemala and who knows what's happening in Venezuela, well, that feeds the problem, right? So there's no simple solution.
Yeah. I think that the mass migrations around the world are likely, at least in part, due to foreign interference in the countries from which people are leaving. It could very well be the case that the U.S. is actually reaping the fruits of the seeds that it has sown over the past decades. Yeah, and I guess just to go back to the main point here, we took a bit of a circuitous route to make the point that the elites, like Edward Bernays and these wealthy people who are in control, they have their own interests in mind. And they're willing to overthrow entire countries to get their way. Now, Dave, let's go a bit more contemporary here and consider the case of SNC-Lavalin. Do you have something to share about that?
This is a Canadian story. So we got to do at least a little bit of Canadian content, being Canadians. And you should play the clip that describes, here's a description of the situation of the Conservative Party leader, Lisa, how do you even pronounce her last name?
I think it's Raitt. Yeah, Raitt.
Raitt?
Yeah, I'm guessing.
Yeah. I just read this stuff. I don't even know how to say it. But play the clip, the number one, the SNC-Lavalin Lisa Raitt there.
The scandal started all the way back in 2001 in Libya. Some executives from SNC-Lavalin bribed Libyan officials with hundreds of millions of dollars and won huge construction contracts as a result. This went on for years until an RCMP investigation led the charges of bribery and corruption. And if found guilty, Canadian law would prevent them from bidding on government contracts. SNC-Lavalin knew that if they didn't have the law changed, that would be it. They would be finished. The connections between SNC-Lavalin and the Liberal Party of Canada are well documented and go back decades. So from the moment Trudeau took office, SNC-Lavalin started a massive lobbying effort to change the criminal code. They met with almost every senior official in Trudeau's government, and the Liberals were ready to listen. The government changed the criminal code by sneaking a new legal provision into a budget bill.
Dave, let me just go right to the next one as well. Here we go.
By putting this change to the law in a budget bill, it looked like an end run around the Department of Justice. Everything was looking good for SNC-Lavalin until they hit a snag. The use of this new law was at the sole discretion of the Director of Public Prosecutions. And the Director of Public Prosecutions informed SNC-Lavalin that no special deal was coming. The only person who could still prevent SNC-Lavalin from being prosecuted for fraud and bribery was Canada's Attorney General, Minister of Justice Jody Wilson-Raybould.
Jody Wilson-Raybould! Yeah!
Yeah, so to summarize here, SNC-Lavalin basically did some illegal stuff, and then they lobbied the government to change the law so they could get off the hook, right?
Yeah.
This is where Jody Wilson-Raybould comes in, who is investigating this alleged illegal activity, and Trudeau and his people were allegedly. Mm-hmm. We have to say that allegedly.
Yes.
Pressuring Jody to let SNC-Lavalin off the hook, right? And
she wouldn't have it, Dave. She wouldn't have it.
She wouldn't have it, exactly.
It didn't work. One of the minions stepped out of line.
Yeah, that's right. She had a conscience. And here's a clip of Jody Wilson-Raybould giving her testimony to the Commons Justice Committee in Ottawa.
Okay, here she is.
For a period of approximately 4 months between September and December of 2018, I experienced a consistent and sustained effort by many people within the government to seek to politically interfere in the exercise of prosecutorial discretion in my role as the Attorney General of Canada in an inappropriate effort to secure a deferred prosecution agreement with SNC-Lavalin. These events involved 11 people, excluding myself and my political staff, from the Prime Minister's office, the Privy Council office, and the office of the Minister of Finance. This included in-person conversations, telephone calls, emails, and text messages. There were approximately 10 phone calls and 10 meetings specifically about SNC, and I and or my staff were a part of these meetings. Within these conversations, there were expressed statements regarding the necessity of interference in the SNC-Lavalin matter, the potential of consequences, and veiled threats if a DPA was not made available to SNC.
Yeah, so Jody Wilson-Raybould is essentially claiming that she was heavily pressured into giving SNC-Lavalin a pass. And I have here a clip from the Conservative MP Michelle Rempel, who sees all of this as an affront to democracy, and she wants Trudeau to come before the Standing Committee on Justice and Human Rights.
He needs to be in front of this committee, and he needs to be held to account. Every person who votes against this is standing and giving him a shield for this type of abrogation of democracy.
Abrogation of democracy. So here we have another case in which the governing elites are not working for the benefit of the general public, but working for their own interests. It seems to be the case that Trudeau and his party are subverting democracy to serve their own agenda.
That's right. And I don't know if you heard, but the the new Attorney General, SNC-Lavalin, happens to be based in his riding.
Oh, no. I don't know.
And he was, when questioned about this, he just sort of feigned ignorance. Oh, well, I just wasn't really involved in any of that.
Yeah. You know, this makes the Liberal government look really bad, because they've been pushing their progressive, sort of feminist, social justice, virtue signaling, inclusive, reconciliation-based agenda. And now they're throwing Jody Wilson-Raybould under the bus. I can't believe it.
That's right.
And she happens to be, I think, a very competent and virtuous First Nations woman. And they're just throwing her under the bus. Yeah, keep showing us your true colors, Justin.
Yeah, we need to see more of that before the next election.
That's right. Now, here's the thing. Ultimately, we've been talking about these elites that are, you know, governing things. Here's the rub. If the elite few are to lead the masses, how do they do so since the numbers are against them? There are few elites, but a lot of plebeians out there, right? A lot of people in the masses. Well, of course, this brings us to the third tenet of the progressive liberal view of democracy, which is that the masses have to be made to conform to a common worldview that the elites want them to have, and this is done by the use of propaganda.
Okay, so I have four quotes from Bernays, and I'll just read them for you, and then maybe we can talk about them.
Okay.
So, quote number one, it remains a fact that in almost every act of our daily lives, whether in the sphere of politics or business, in our social conduct or our ethical thinking, we are dominated by a relatively small number of persons who understand the mental processes and social patterns of the masses. It is they who pull the wires which control the public mind, who harness old social forces and contrive new ways to bind and guide the world.
Yeah, so he uses the phrase control the public mind, if I heard you correctly.
This idea of binding.
Oh, yeah.
Guiding. Binding the public mind.
Yeah,
right?
that's an awesome catch, man. Here's something for you.
You're awesome, Uncle Dave.
That's Gracie. I just wanted to play that. That's a really good point. Binding and guiding. Yeah. Binding and guiding the world. That's so interesting. Okay. Anyways, go on to the next
Gracie
one.
Gracie just became my favorite niece here.
You got a lot to choose from, so.
Yeah, that's right.
Go on.
All right, Bernays. So another one here. But given our present political conditions under which every office seeker must cater to the vote of the masses, the only means by which the born leader can lead is the expert use of propaganda.
Expert use of propaganda. There it is.
Okay, this is from earlier in the book. Mm-hmm. The minority has discovered a powerful help in influencing the majorities. It has been found possible so to mold the mind of the masses that they will throw their newly gained strength in the desired direction. Propaganda is the executive arm of the invisible government.
Yeah, just going back to the book here, Dave, going to those pages, and it's chapter 2, if I remember here, in Bernays' book, and he starts
on page 47 there.
Yeah, I got it. So he starts that chapter by talking about the days of kings. In the days when kings were kings, Louis XIV made his modest remark, "L'état, c'est moi." And he was nearly right, says Bernays. And the basic idea that Bernays is saying is back in the days, the king was in control of things. But then there were these democratic movements where you had the common people starting to take more power in society. And that changed the dynamic. And he says, so in the end, universal suffrage and universal schooling reinforced this tendency. And at last, even the bourgeoisie stood in fear of the common people, for the masses promised to become king, right? So the masses would now start to rule themselves. And then he says the following, today, however, a reaction has set in. The minority has discovered a powerful help in influencing the majority. So somehow the minority had to counteract the masses, right? And this what we call the democratic power. And that was by controlling the masses by propaganda. Anyways, go on there, Dave.
So here's another quote from Bernays. No serious sociologist any longer believes that the voice of the people expresses any divine or specially wise and lofty idea. The voice of the people expresses the mind of the people, and the mind is made up for it by the group leaders in whom it believes and by those persons who understand the manipulation of public opinion.
Oh, that's amazing. The voice of the people expresses the mind of the people, and the mind is made up for it.
For it, yes.
By the group leaders in whom it believes. It reminds me of that saying where, you know, the head leads, but the neck turns the head.
Yeah, and notice what's interesting here. Well, I guess it was in the one before, but the invisible government.
Yes, this is kind of this hidden thing that's kind of operating behind the scenes. Yeah. You know, Walter Lippmann explains why and how propaganda works so well in shaping people's worldviews. He points out that the key is that people don't have access to all the information, which means that a person's worldview will necessarily be based on information he or she is given. So think about a recent example. Let's imagine the war in Syria, right? How do you conceptualize that war? Right? How do you conceptualize what the rebels are doing or maybe what the white helmets are doing? Well, it's based on the simple repeated pieces of information and pictures that you're shown and that you receive through the media, right? Because you can't go there, or not many of us can actually go there and experience the whole thing. And so that's why you can use propaganda to manipulate people, because they can't access all the true information. And in his book, Public Opinion, Lippmann develops the idea of using symbols for propaganda purposes. Okay, listen to this quote. Quote, since the general opinions of large numbers of persons are almost certainly to be a vague and confusing medley, action cannot be taken until these opinions have been factored down, canalized, and compressed and made uniform. The making of one general will out of a multitude of general wishes consists essentially in the use of symbols, which assemble emotions after they have been detached from their ideas. Because feelings are much less specific than ideas, and yet more poignant, the leader is able to make a homogeneous will out of a heterogeneous mass of desires. So the propagandist can use general symbols, which are flexible in that different people can attach different interpretations to them, and they are more focused on eliciting emotions than on communicating information, because common emotions are more easily elicited than common ideas. And so you can think of recent examples, Dave, like the quote, make America great again. For many,
You can bring a lot of yourself to that statement, right?
Exactly. People can agree with that statement, even though they may have completely different ideas of what it means to make a great, what it means to make America great again, right?
And because it has this ability to do that, you'll notice the media now trying to fill that "Make America Great Again" with negative emotion, negative sentiment, negative content by associating it with hate crimes, right? Associating it with racism or any of that negative stuff, right?
Precisely, because that slogan, "Make America Great Again," has the power to elicit a lot of positive emotions, right? Because, and it even actually goes back for some people to Ronald Reagan, the former president, who actually was the first to use that slogan, I think, in American politics. But similarly, as you point out very correctly, Dave, then the opposition tries to fill it with negative emotions, right? And that's the way to dissuade people, not by rational argumentation, but by filling it with... Dave, this is another awesome point that you made here. I got to give you one of these.
Great point, Uncle Dave.
Yeah. I got to get myself one of those for you.
Exactly. We need some more of these. Yeah. Lippmann writes the following, Dave, quote, since the offering of symbols is so generous and the meaning that can be imputed is so elastic, how does any particular symbol take root in any particular person's mind? It is planted there by another human being whom we recognize as authoritative. If it is planted deeply enough, it may be that later we shall call the person authoritative who waves the symbol at us. And so he talks about here that there are certain people that we see as authoritative, and they have this power to create these symbols. And then later, when somebody else uses those symbols, they're going to have lots of power. And that's exactly the case of the MAGA, because Ronald Reagan used it before, and he was highly esteemed by many on the right in the population. And so when Trump pulled it out, he was basically piggybacking on the quote-unquote authority of Ronald Reagan. And of course, you can contrast Trump's slogan with Hillary's slogan, "I'm with her," and you can clearly see that wouldn't have any unifying effect, right?
Yeah. No, good point.
Because it puts Hillary
I need my
at
own
the center.
Point button here.
Yeah, exactly. It puts Hillary at the center of attention, right? And she doesn't have that unifying power. In fact, she has this power to separate. See, Trump didn't actually put himself at the center. He did that a lot later, right? When he says, like, "I'm the only one that can fix the economy." But not with his slogan, all right? His slogan was about making America great again, which could basically be this huge umbrella that can draw a lot of people in.
Yeah, that is a good point. That is a very good point.
So Dave, in his book titled Public Opinion, Lippmann calls this process of molding the view of the public manufacture of consent, quote unquote, or quote unquote creation of consent. And then later Chomsky uses that concept for the title of his book, Manufacturing Consent. And Lippmann says the following, quote, "The creation of consent is not a new art. It is a very old one, which was supposed to have died out with the appearance of democracy. But it has not died out. It has, in fact, improved enormously in technique because it is now based on analysis rather than on rules of thumb." So it's become more scientifically used. And there are, in fact, now fields in psychology that are looking at how to manufacture consent more effectively. And Harold Lasswell, the political scientist I think we referred to him right at the beginning, in his 1938 book titled Propaganda Techniques in the World Wars, argues that propaganda is already heavily used in all governing bodies and across the democratic countries. He writes the following, quote, "Inside a democratic country, there's a certain presumption against government propaganda," end quote. Yes, indeed, there is. But, quote, "the truth is that all governments are engaged to some extent in propaganda as part of their ordinary peacetime functions," end quote. Quote, "the only question is the degree to which the government should try to conduct its propaganda secretly and the degree to which it should conduct it openly." So everybody's doing it, yeah. Dave. Yeah. So, Dave, I think the argument could be made that propaganda, and I think the liberal democratic thinkers thought this, is in fact an important and necessary part of a functioning democracy.
Yeah, given their idea of whose ideas should be governing the society.
Yeah, and I think Bernays said this quite explicitly.
That's right.
I think I have a quote here from him. "The conscious and intelligent manipulation of the organized habits and opinions of the masses is an important element in democratic society." Okay, so not just useful. They would say it's important.
Mm-hmm. And he also says a little bit later this. He says, just a couple pages later, "it's not usually realized how necessary these invisible governors are to the orderly function of group life."
Yeah. So, Dave, maybe we could go back now very quickly to the SNC-Lavalin case, because I think it's a good recent example of how the government was about to use propaganda to manipulate the public against their own interests, right?
Yeah, this is a really good example.
Yeah, because
Just going back, just recall. So Jody Wilson-Raybould she's investigating this alleged activity of SNC-Lavalin, and Trudeau and his people were allegedly pressuring Jody to let SNC-Lavalin off the hook.
Yes.
Okay. So remember that. So in her testimony in the Commons, Jody delivers this, you could call it a master class on how to give credible and compelling testimony. And this is what she says. So just play that clip about the op-eds.
Yeah.
"They seem quite keen on the idea of you retaining an ex-Supreme Court of Canada judge to get advice on this. Katie Telford thinks it gives us cover in the business community and the legal community, and that it would allow the prime minister to say we were doing something. She was like, quote, if Jody is nervous, we would, of course, line up all kinds of people to write op-eds saying that what she is doing is proper, end quote.
Wow, Dave.
So the liberals are ready to write articles in the news media, not op-eds,
right,
but still influence opinion makers pieces to justify this dodgy decision they wanted Jody to make.
I mean, this is – talk about manufacturing consent, but this is exactly how it's done, right? So what they will do,
yep,
is just start writing articles, these op-eds, and then people are just sitting there consuming these things 24/7, and they read these opinions and they become their own opinions. And then all of a sudden, oh yeah, it's a great thing that Jody, you know, let SNC-Lavalin off the hook. Thankfully, Jody didn't do that, but that's
or
exactly.
Or at least it was a necessary evil, jobs are at stake, blah, blah, whatever they would have written. It would have been a spectrum of opinions where you could, based on your persuasion or your moral compass, could find yourself in some of them, in one or a few of them, and sort of agree or fully agree that this was the right thing to do.
Totally. So it's a great example of, I mean, this didn't actually unfold, but this is what was allegedly being planned to unfold, which means that it's probably a tactic that's been used quite frequently. It's amazing when you kind of get these little nuggets, right, that are revealed, these little revelations. We got to start collecting all these revelations. Dave, we're kind of getting along in our time here, but let me just go to the kind of the fourth key tenet of the progressive liberal view, and let's spend a few minutes on that. So according to Chomsky, the progressive liberal view also holds that the general population must be kept passive and distracted. Okay, listen to this.
Their job is to be spectators, not participants. They're allowed to vote every once in a while, pick out one of us smart guys, but then they're supposed to go home and do something else, like, you know, watch the football game or whatever it may be.
So as Chomsky puts it, the rest of the bewildered herd basically just have to be distracted. And that's from his book, I think, Media Control. And the news media is great at providing these useless distractions. And here's a clip from the Mar Chomsky interview where Chomsky talks about how the media talks about useless things to keep the population distracted.
When the press focuses on the sex lives of politicians, reach for your pocket and see who's pulling out your wallet. I mean, because those are not the issues that matter to people. I mean, they're very marginal interest. The issues that matter to people are somewhere else.
Yeah, so all these sexual scandals, they're basically just distractions, according to Chomsky, to keep everybody distracted from what's really going on. And you can think of examples, let's say, in the American media, right? Listen to this.
A California judge just ordered porn star and director Stormy Daniels to pay nearly $300,000 in legal fees.
To the other breaking political headline, the legal battle between the president and Stormy Daniels.
The president avoids any questions about Stormy Daniels.
Here with me is someone who knows what it's like to be accused by the president of pulling off a hoax, and that's Stormy Daniels, and she has a new memoir out. It's titled Full Disclosure.
Who watched the Stormy Daniels interview? The adult film star on 60 Minutes detailing her account of having sexual intercourse with Donald Trump over a decade ago.
A U.S. judge has dismissed a lawsuit by adult actress Stormy Daniels.
You notice, Dave, they use things like porn star and sexual intercourse, like all these words, very salacious, you know, because they know that the people will want to listen to that sort of thing. And they just fixate on it. And those were just a few of the news reels. I mean, it was going on in the States for a very long time, right? News story after news story.
Absolutely. And the important part is to realize that, okay, that's one aspect of it. But then there's this fixation on sports.
Yeah.
Right. There's this fixation on sports stars, movie stars.
That's right. And we can add to that maybe distractions that people just engage in all the time, such as social media and online TV like Netflix, reality shows, video games. I mean, we can go on and on. These are all techniques or ways or tools out there that distract the population from focusing on what's really happening in the world. Now, Chomsky, go on, Dave.
Well, I was just simply going to agree. I think that's absolutely right. It ties up your energies and uses your mind that would normally be could be occupied solving real world problems or building things and creating things into simply dissipates them in this kind of stuff. And you notice how much of this stuff is addictive.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
This whole idea of binging on Netflix. They created this idea that there's just so much of this. The video games, maybe sometime we can devote a show to that whole concept. But
it makes me think of that term Bernays used, binding. Binding
yeah.
again.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Now, Chomsky adds that the elites have to make sure that the bewildered herd, quote, remains at most spectators of action, occasionally lending their weight to one or another of the real leaders who they may select among.
Yeah, that's the interesting part, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're given leaders to choose from, but you know, we're led to believe that we select these potential leaders, but the choice is already constrained.
And what's really interesting with that is it gives us an illusion of choice without really giving us control. So if you think about it as an example, I could think of, you know, telling my kids that they have an option between cleaning the bathroom or, let's say, cleaning the kitchen, right? So they do have a choice, but only from the options I provide. They can't, for example, choose to go and play outside because I haven't given them that option. And so, and here's the important part, regardless of which of the two options they choose, I get my way. Right? Because they're working within mm-hmm. the constraints that I've offered them. And I think this is why the democratic duopolies or triopolies, as the case may be in Canada, don't actually lead to any significant change. In many cases, the elites don't really care who we elect because their main interests are always going to be taken care of because they've selected the possible candidates for us to choose among.
That's right. And you can kind of see it's almost a game with the politicians. You know, they congratulate themselves for winning this or that election. And there's a lot on the line for them individually. But the grander thing is oh, you guys stole this election. We're going to steal the next one. Ha, ha, ha.
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of nonsense, right?
That's right. So one example, I think, of some evidence that people working actually in the political sphere know that part of the task is to keep the population passive. One example comes from the WikiLeaks. Remember when the DNC was ostensibly hacked and there was this release of the WikiLeaks emails, some of, I think it was Hillary Clinton's emails, and there's an email from Bill Ivey who is involved with the Democratic Party.
So here it is. But all policy actors have been far too content to figure out policy from the inside, making our ideals inside DC, then slicing up the country demographically every few years and targeting groups with slogans, promises to change things, etc., with small initiatives, quote-unquote, guaranteed to push their voting buttons. This style of governing, combined with the complete abandonment of education and history, civics, etc., means we have both anger and ignorance abroad in the land, and it is difficult to gauge how wide and deep it is.
Yeah, abandonment of education and history and civics, that's intriguing.
Yeah, you know, I think about civics. Civics is the study of the rights and duties of citizenship.
Right.
Okay, and if I look back on our education when we were in primary grades and even you know, secondary education, there's basically none of that.
Yeah, I have no memory of any of that, of any right? being and taught so any of it.
The funny part is, I mean, part of this, us doing this podcast is to sort of re-educate ourselves and stuff that should have been already there.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, and notice that he uses the concept here of targeting groups with slogans, promises to change things, etc., which is exactly the symbols, right? It's the symbols yeah. that, so they know they're doing
to
all this.
To push their voting buttons.
Exactly. To control them. this is so nutty, yeah. right?
But what's interesting here is that he admits that the problem is that they have no idea now how much anger and ignorance is actually afoot now.
That's right.
Losing, but, so they're, it's a little bit of a problem for them because now they can't gauge it.
Okay, but here's the next part of this email. Okay, here, yeah. I have it here, so I'll read it.
Go ahead.
And as I've mentioned, we've all been quite content to demean government, drop civics, and in general, conspire to produce an unaware and compliant citizenry. So yep. He makes the case. He says, we've all been quite content to conspire to produce an unaware and compliant citizenry. I mean, that's just nutty, Dave. They're saying it in their own communications. It goes on. The unawareness remains strong, but compliance is obviously fading rapidly. Oh, no. So he's sad that the compliance is fading. He'd be happy if there was unawareness and compliance, but the problem is the compliance is fading. So now we got to actually talk about it, right? So he goes on. This problem demands some serious, serious thinking and not just poll-driven, demographically inspired messaging. So he's realizing he's got to think about this because the whole plan is falling apart, Dave. The people aren't passive anymore. They're not becoming passive. They're not complying.
Yeah.
Well, okay, let's just go now to sort of the last point that we want to make in this podcast. So if you're listening, we're maybe past the hour, and so just hold on just for a few more minutes, because right now this is a very, very important key point we want to make. And here's the point. The upshot of this progressive theory of liberal democracy, the key implication is that education and the mass media take on a completely different purpose than what you imagine it they ought to be, their purposes ought to be under a more common theory of democracy. And according to this liberal democratic theory, education serves a two-pronged purpose. Chomsky talks about this. The first is to indoctrinate some of the population, a minority of the population, into the intellectual class so they are ready to carry out the worldview of the elites. And Chomsky writes about this in his book, Media Control, and I'm picking up mid-sentence, quote, they, the elite, have to have instilled in them, the intellectual class, the beliefs and doctrines that will serve the interests of private power. Unless they can master that skill, they're not part of the specialized class. They have to be deeply indoctrinated in the values and interests of private power and the state corporate nexus that represents it. So he's saying here that this intellectual class, which would really be sort of the liberal arts educated class, you know, from coming out from the elite education institutions, they have to be indoctrinated so that they serve the interests of the state corporate nexus of power. So that's one point. But the second prong of education, according to this view, is to make the rest of the population passive and submissive. And so the point here is not to educate them. The point is to make them passive and submissive. And with regard to educating people to be informed voters, Lippmann writes in the book Phantom Public the following, quote, the usual appeal to education can bring only disappointment, for the problems of the modern world appear and change faster than any set of teachers can grasp them, much faster than they can convey their substance to a population of children, end quote. So he's saying, look, you can't educate people fast enough to make them into informed democratic voters. And then he says, in a slightly earlier section, quote, that is why the usual appeal to education as the remedy for the incompetence of democracy is so barren, saying education won't help. And so here is the quintessential point, Dave. Are you ready?
Yep.
In the view of these liberal progressives, education and the truthful use of mass media cannot solve what they see as a fundamental problem of democracy. And so therefore, education and the mass media become used for a different purpose. Rather than being used to truthfully inform the public, they are used instead as a tool for propaganda, to manufacture consent among the people and to indoctrinate them with the views that the elites want them to have.
So basically, to make this work, the educators themselves have to become propagandists.
Exactly.
Right? And this is what Bernays argued, that the educator should actually be trained in propaganda, and that one of their main functions should be to serve as propagandists. And he writes this, he says, The normal school should provide for the training of the educator to make him realize that this is a twofold job, education as a teacher and education as a propagandist.
Oh, man. So
Dan, we don't have time for this, and we're going to have to do a separate episode on this, but we got to get into the work of John Taylor Gatto, who I think he just recently died, but he's got a whole bunch of books. One is, people may have heard, Dumbing Us Down.
Yes.
The other one is The Underground History of American Education. And the third one, the title just simply fits here, Weapons of Mass Instruction.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Okay.
That's right in with the
Weapons of Mass Instruction, A School Teacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling. So we're going to have to get into that if we want to get into this a little bit deeper. This whole education thing.
Yeah.
Right?
Dave, I have here a related quote from the French philosopher Jacques Ellul, author of the book titled Propaganda, The Formation of Men's Attitudes. I think we mentioned this one before, published in 1965. And he makes the point that propaganda quickly takes over education. And he says the following, quote, "No contrast can be tolerated between teaching and propaganda, between the critical spirit formed by higher education and the exclusion of independent thought. One must use the education of the young to condition them to what comes later." End quote.
Okay, you got to give me a minute here to talk about this article that I've had sitting here since February. Wanted to get into it. The Chinese kindergartners forced to sign atheist manifesto.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, this is an article from Breitbart. And before you start dissing Breitbart, the thing is, Western media typically are not covering this.
It's okay? The alt-right, Dave. You can't read Breitbart.
Yeah, you can't. Well, it's either true or not. That's the thing. If you want me to ditch this, you got to tell me, you got to prove to me that this is actually not true.
Go ahead.
And
go ahead.
There's Asian sources for this stuff. You can dig them out as well.
Yes.
But this one's, it's got a nice and compressed. So the Education Bureau of the Chinese District of Laishan has launched a campaign to eradicate religious belief in kindergartens, which includes having the school children sign a commitment statement promising to avoid religious activities. Okay, now get this. This is on point here. Both pupils and teachers are now required to sign a commitment statement, okay, promising that they won't browse religious websites or participate in religious forums, according to recent reports. Okay, and that's where you can click on and you'll get these Asian things. So the commitment statement includes, get this, the declaration. I will adhere to the correct political direction.
Oh, my goodness. It's it's totally in your face there.
Like only in Asia could you get away with this blatantly, but hopefully that's not coming here. So I will adhere to the correct political direction, advocate science, promote atheism, and oppose theism.
Oh, man.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's the
communist perspective. Later on, Dave, we're going to actually read parts of the Communist Manifesto because I think some of our listeners might have never read it and they're revealing things in there, but this is completely consistent with that. Go ahead.
Exactly. So the new campaign forbids schools from hiring new teachers who hold religious beliefs while calling for increased supervision of current teaching staff, including, quote, comprehensive inspections of teachers' preparation for lessons in order to root out any and all religious content. Okay?
Wow.
Now, part of this is basically forbidding students, any children, are not allowed to go to attend churches with their parents. They're just going to be barred at the door. And teachers are not allowed to, it says, along with students, school teachers also have been banned from attending church. The Yonglin district instructed schools that, quote, the higher authorities strictly forbid all secondary and primary school teachers, students, and toddlers to join Catholic or Protestant churches.
Yeah.
And Chinese authorities have justified their action by alleging that church attendance and religious instruction keep young persons from developing, quote, a correct worldview and set of values, end quote.
Yeah, see, okay. and they define the correct worldview and the values, of course.
That's right. And so one more quote here. Minors receiving religious education and formation too early in churches would seriously affect the normal implementation of the educational system, end quote. The Ojai District notice declared.
Wow.
Right? So this is exactly what we just talked about. It's just the thing is you can implement this in a more authoritarian system like the Chinese communist system, they can just blatantly do this. But propaganda, especially when you look at the The John Taylor Gatto stuff does the same thing, essentially.
Well, Dave, that's because, the Chinese are basically have a communist system that's styled to some extent after Leninism. Mm-hmm. Listen to this quote by Noam Chomsky.
Actually, it's very similar to Leninism. It translates almost exactly into the Leninist line.
He's talking about this progressive liberal worldview is almost exactly or very similar, if not exactly like Leninism. Listen again.
It's very similar to Leninism. It translates almost exactly into the Leninist line. The party dictatorship, we do things for you and you're too dumb to do it yourself, and we're doing it in the interest of everyone and so on. And I suspect that that's part of the reason why it's been so easy historically for people to shift up and back from being a, sort of enthusiastic Stalinist to being a big supporter of U.S. power. I mean, people go up and back without any difficulty. I mean,
did you hear that?
Yeah. That's good. Very good point.
Yeah, because see, both of these kinds of systems, they are very similar because they have a ruling oligarchy that then tries to control the masses through propaganda, which is exactly the whole theme of this podcast.
Yeah, good point. Okay, so let's just summarize then the main conclusions about the progressive liberal worldview.
Okay, so I'll try to give it a summary here. So the political elite have a view of democracy that I think is quite different from the view held by most people in the West. And this has been going on for a long time. In fact, I've got another couple quotes here from Lippmann. Quote, in fact, the realistic political thinkers in Europe long ago abandoned the notion that the collective mass of the people direct the course of public affairs, end quote. So this has been known in the elite circles for a long time. This view has been held in elite circles for a long time. And they feel that they can get away with it because the public will be distracted and not paying attention. And so Lippmann writes, quote, the public will arrive in the middle of the third act and will leave before the last curtain, having stayed just long enough perhaps to decide who's the hero and who's the villain of the piece, end quote. And they're not going to really be paying attention the rest of the time when the real story unfolds. And rather than being used to educate and truthfully inform the public, the mass media and the education system have instead been used for propaganda purposes, to control the population from the crib to the grave. And that's because the elite is composed of a few people, and somehow they have to assert control over a large population of people. And propaganda is the easiest, most palatable tool that can be used to do this.
All right, so let's close it up. I did want to thank again our Joshua, who emailed us, and we're looking forward to taking a look at Chomsky's book of what Uncle Sam really wants, and this whole business of news cycles. So maybe that might one day be a topic. And with that, I want to, if anybody has suggestions for us and sees things out there that catalog and illustrate nicely some of the points we've made, please feel free to email us at info@notconformshow.com. Now, I can't promise we're going to reply to everybody's email, but we'll from time to time pick something out and read it on the air and discuss it. And we do really appreciate your feedback. So thanks for that. So that's info@notconformshow.com. And you can check us out on our website at www.notconformshow.com. which will take you to the podcast website with the detailed show notes and links and all that kind of stuff. So thanks very much for listening, and we'll talk to you again in the next episode.
Listen to you later, Dave.